The following program, a regular service from the North Carolina Reading Service, is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. It's the Indie Week, and this issue is dated August the 4th of 2023. And our jaunty theme song introduces me, John Feddersen, who is reading this week's issue of Indie Week. Also, IndieWeek.com. We get articles from both sources, the online version and the biweekly print edition of Indie Week. We'll start off from Wake County in the Wake County Schools. The public schools formalized on Tuesday how people can challenge books and instructional materials they find inappropriate or offensive. This is revised wording to Policy 3210. Requires principals to schedule a meeting with the person who's concerned about a book or piece of instructional material. Previously, the person only had to submit a complaint in writing. The updated policy adds more details to this process, including how a parent can obtain a request for reconsideration of instructional materials form. The timeline to file this paperwork has been extended from 10 days to 20, after which point the complaint is considered closed. If the parent files after the deadline, a new process will start. There will be an outside committee consisting of the media coordinator, teachers familiar with the subject of the challenged book, parents, and a school counselor who will read and research the challenged material. They will deliberate their findings at a public meeting. Appeals can be made to the school district's Central Instructional Materials Committee. If the committee finds a book or other material violates the rights of the student or the parent, the family will be accommodated. If the material is deemed too vulgar for school, student access will be modified or it will be removed. The decision made by the Central Instructional Materials Committee is binding for 2 years. During this time, no further challenges against the same material in question will be reviewed. According to district representatives, only 5 books went through this formal book challenge process since 2021. Lawn Boy, Out of Darkness, Melissa, Call Me Max, and Dear Martin. They said they have no records of how many complaints were dropped after a discussion with the school principal. Cecilia Joyce is a librarian in the Wake County School District with over 20 years of experience in education. She said she loves all the joys and challenges of her bustling school libraries. She said at Tuesday's school board meetings, books help shape kids, too. They open up windows to see the world and offer mirrors of the kids reflected and doors for them to join in new possibilities. Joyce said the book banners are motivated by fear of people they consider other in some way. Book banners are looking to tear down our public schools and challenge professional educators. Some people at the meeting were concerned that when a student's parent or guardian wanted to file a formal challenge, the district could, quote, drag out the process until the year is over. Colleen Miller said she's a member of the Pavement Education Project. That's an initiative formed in response to sexual books and instructional materials that are found in public schools. The project does not list its staff, volunteers, or supporters on its website or Facebook page. Miller told the board the books in question were part of a bigger transition to push non-traditional values. She said to the board, classical literature is being purged from our school libraries and even our public libraries and being replaced with books that are in writing, ideologies that I find actually probably for young children to read. I don't quite understand that sentence, but that's what's printed here. Miller said to the board, and so she went on, there will be consequences for this inaction on restricting inappropriate materials to minors and age-appropriate materials to minors. What should be done? Otherwise, you set yourself up for criminal and civil liability. There will be a day of reckoning. The next article by Joe Killian was originally published at North Carolina Newsline. It's about the UNC Chapel Hill policy, which all but bans asking applicants about racial experiences. The UNC Chapel Hill Board of Trustees passed changes to the university's non-discrimination policy Thursday that some members warned go well beyond last month's U.S. Supreme Court decision against considering race in admission. The High Court's ruling found using race as a criterion in admissions decision to be a violation of the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause. But it also explicitly stated, quote, "Nothing in this opinion should be construed as prohibiting universities from considering an applicant's discussion of how race affected his or her life, be it through discrimination, inspiration, or otherwise." Conservative critics have seized on that line, warning colleges and universities could ask such questions as a proxy for race. The new policy language passed in the resolution by the Board of Trustees Thursday would make it nearly impossible to craft questions or to consider answers about racial experiences or how race has affected an applicant's life. The resolution reads, "The university shall not establish through application essays or other means any proxies premised upon race-based preferences in hiring or admissions. If the university considers the personal experience of applicants for admission, each applicant must be treated based on his or her experiences as an individual, not on the basis of race." At least one board member, Ralph Meekins, warned against passage of this resolution before consulting carefully with university counsel. Quote, "I know for a fact this resolution goes well beyond the Supreme Court ruling, and if you talk to any lawyer, they'll tell you the same." Meekins is an attorney, and he continued, "I don't know what the opinion of our lawyers is on this, or actually I do, but I can't disclose what the opinion is. And I think every member of this board, before you vote on this resolution, needs to know, number one, if there are any legal implications, and if they are, what they are, how it may affect the university. Whatever members might think of such a resolution, philosophically or politically," Meekins said, "they need to consider potential legal repercussions. My duty on this board," he said, "my fiduciary duty is to the University of North Carolina, and I don't want to see any harm come to the university from any kind of resolution, particularly this one. My duty is not to my own ideology, what I'd like to see happen. I have a lot of reasons why I'm against this resolution, but before we even get to that point, I implore each of us to consider that and not vote on this until you've talked to your legal team." The board elected to approve the resolution over these objections. Though a roll call vote was not taken, the overwhelming majority of board members seemed to vote in favor. Board member Marty Kotis has pushed for a similar resolution since joining the trustees from the UNC Board of Governors 2 years ago. But when the university was still engaged in a lawsuit making its way to the Supreme Court, members were reluctant to insert any additional such language to university policy. That changed with the recent ruling. Kotis supported Thursday's resolution, though it contained amendments that went beyond the language he originally suggested. And he said, "You know, I think the punchline to this resolution is to end discrimination. You have to end discrimination. And that's what we're seeking to do. That's what the court has ruled. That's what we've been discussing for the past couple of years. And over the last couple of years, there's been plenty of opportunity to discuss with our attorneys." As Newsline has reported, the Supreme Court ruling has led to a clash of interpretations and battles of how far colleges and universities should go in reacting to it. In a roundtable discussion on the issue earlier this month, David Hinojosa, director of the Educational Opportunities Project at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, said universities are within their rights and within the law to ask students how race has impacted their lives. In the wake of the Supreme Court decision, however, conservative activists almost immediately began contacting colleges and universities to make demands and threaten further lawsuits. Hinojosa pointed to a letter sent earlier this month by Edward Bloom, president of Students for Fair Admissions, to 150 colleges and universities, making a series of demands that align with the group's interpretation of the decision. In its own response letter, Hinojosa's group called Blum's letter, quote, an effort to overstate the reach of the decision and stoke fears through implicit and explicit threats of litigation. Board member John Pryor was among several trustees clearly frustrated that the university had defended affirmative action and admissions in the first place. He interrupted comments by Chapel Hill Chancellor Kevin Guskiewicz Thursday during the first full board meeting since the decision to give a speech about the folly of doing so. Quote, I think it's instructive, as we are just about to start this meeting, to reflect on what's happened with the Supreme Court case, where for 9 years we've spent in the neighborhood of $35 million to lose a high-profile case in which we were found to have been in violation of the 14th Amendment. I want everybody to think about it, because this is a moment of humility. It's a moment I know a lot of people thought we were fighting a good fight and it needed to be fought, but as it turns out, we were actually doing something we shouldn't have been doing. Pryor said the university should take the lesson and consider whether it can spend millions on things more beneficial to students, like covering the cost of tuition and fees. The board should, in light of the Supreme Court decision, he said, examine several other decisions, priorities, and policies. Now, this article continues to read the full resolution as passed by the Board of Trustees. It's a couple pages long with whereases and therefores. I'm going to exclude that from this reading, but you can find it at indyweek.com and read that sidebar of the entire resolution, or go online to NC Newsline and read it. If there's time and the rest of this broadcast, then I'll include it if there's time. Next, an article from last week's issue, which I did not have time to read it because it was lengthy. Now I have time. And it starts basically from Orange County, and it's about the Bolin Creek. And it's written by Cy Neff. The headwaters of Bolin Creek begin their slow trickle in the center of Orange County, a clay-colored stream thin enough to jump across, winding oxbows framed by tree roots and dark clusters of ferns. Bolin Creek gradually grows wider and turns a thin, clearish brown beer bottle color and meanders through farmland, forests, and suburbs until its waters merge to form Little Creek, which drains into Jordan Lake. There are around 50 streams in Orange County, but few have been as controversial as Bolin. Two sections of greenway currently run along the creek, a roughly mile-long portion in North Carrboro in the Hogan Farms subdivision, and a 2.5-mile stretch north of downtown Chapel Hill, ending just past Franklin Street. Talks of constructing a paved greenway next to the creek between these two paths have started and stalled repeatedly in the past decades. Chapel Hill resident Patrick Quirk, who lives near the Chapel Hill stretch and hopes to see progress on the greenway in the coming year, says, I don't know if there's a debate so much anymore. It's two camps that just want different things. I don't think there's any communication happening between the two sides. A contentious Carrboro Town Council meeting from 2009 was intended to conclude months of planning and public engagement with a potential adoption of the town's proposed Greenway Master Plan. A grainy video shows a handful of residents interrupting town council members, asserting there hasn't been enough community input. The town council accedes and ends the meeting, directing town staff to re-explore possible greenway alignments. After more than a decade, Carrboro's town council formally reopened public engagement on the proposal, with the debate beginning anew at a February meeting this year. The renewal is tied to the shifting winds of Orange County politics. Groups embracing and advocating for responsible growth, such as NextNC, are gaining increasing local traction, while established largely anti-development groups such as Chapel Hill Alliance for a Livable Town are seeing their influence fade. This has happened in tandem with an 11% population jump in Orange County since the debate's inception, as well as a 2021 and 22 election that altered the makeup of the Carrboro Town Council. A new petition emerged in April asking citizens to write to town officials and oppose the proposed greenway. A fiery blog post fact-checking and critiquing the petition published just a week later. If a tree falls in Bolin Forest, everybody will hear about it. Some might even write op-eds. It's March 27th, 2023, and I'm sitting in on a Carrboro Council meeting and feeling deja vu. Copies of a Bolin Creek Greenway master plan from 2009 sit on council members' desks. The 3.5-mile connector phases off the Bolin Creek Greenway remain unbuilt and controversial, and the council has not addressed the subject until it was resurrected at a meeting on Valentine's Day. The maps and graphs are also from 2009. Two council members sat in this same room 14 years ago, as well as some town staff and folks in the audience. The March meeting ends with a 6-1 vote, directing town staff to pursue public engagement over potential alignments for the Bolin Creek Greenway, with a deadline to report back by mid-October. In mid-June, the town of Carrboro launched an extensive Bolin Creek Greenway public engagement website, the largest concrete measure taken to resolve the greenway debate. The website offers a map with three potential greenway routes, a list of frequently asked questions, a survey for Carrboro residents available in four languages, a list of events at which to engage with town staff, and a historical timeline. Opponents, notably Bolin Forest Climate Action, characterize the website as inadequate, arguing that the site relies on old information and doesn't sufficiently educate the public on the environmental effects of paving in a riparian zone. Discussions around Carrboro greenways have gone on for decades, with plans for greenways consistently emerging in the town's planning surveys, conceptual master plans, and parks and rec plans. Carrboro voters approved a bond in 2003, allocating almost $300,000 for a greenway construction in the town. A 2006 Parks and Rec master plan offered a possible vision for a connecting set of greenways around Carrboro. And the 2009 Bolin Creek Greenway conceptual master plan sought to identify a greenway corridor that would have minimal environmental damage, facilitate outdoor recreation, and provide opportunities for non-motorized transit. The 2009 master plan introduced the controversial Bolin Creek stretch, following an existing OWASA sewer easement as a preferable alignment. It is a particularly beautiful stretch of creek. Steep hills cut almost right up to the river bank. Tall rock outcroppings sprout laurels. In the cold months, leaves lie penny-colored under barren green trees, and the only green colors come from the needles of junipers and red cedars and pale lichens clinging to silver-gray bark. In the warm months, the creek is bordered with a green underglow of river oats, Water bugs cast speckled shadows on the creek floor, and tadpoles wiggle their tails in standing water by the side of the dirt and gravel path. Would laying down a path here unnecessarily bring in more traffic and degrade one of the most serene urban forests left in the triangle? Or would it allow more residents to access, utilize, and cherish a natural resource nestled in the heart of their town? Sources on both sides of the issue hold similar academic and professional credentials, as well as largely aligned political values. Everyone interviewed for this story says they care for the environment and are pro-Greenway generally. But the same set of facts consistently produce disparate, wildly variable conclusions among stakeholders. Chuck Flink, the owner of Greenways Incorporated, served as a consultant on the Town of Carrboro's 2009 conceptual master plan and designed a separate section of Greenway along Chapel Hill's Bolin Creek in the 1990s. Flink has developed design greenways in 36 states and says Carrboro's controversy is not unusual for highly educated university communities. Disagreements center primarily around the Creekside Greenway alignment's transit benefits, potential environmental impact, and a location on the sewer easement. Proponents argue that a greenway would seamlessly connect Carrboro's northern neighborhoods and Chapel Hill High, Smith Middle, and Sewell Elementary with Chapel Hill's approved greenway extension to Estes Drive, creating a safe, car-free route to travel from northern Carrboro all the way down to University Mall. Proponents also argue that having accessible green spaces nearby would enhance residents' connection with nature and reduce their need to drive to farther away forests. Carrboro resident Melva Oaken says, "I started hiking in these woods over 40 years ago, and at the time, there wasn't even a path going down to get you down the stream. I don't need to drive to the mountains to do a lovely stream walk. I don't even need to drive to Duke Forest or to a state park to walk in a lovely wooded area." Opponents say there are better alignments that offer the same transportation benefits. They liken the project to paving the creek. Carrboro resident and Friends of Bolin Creek member Diane Robertson says, "It isn't like you order carpet and they come in and roll it out and all's well. It isn't something that lies flat on paper and you see a line and you say, wouldn't it be nice to have a pathway right there? It is a major construction project in a fragile ecosystem." Tranquil as it is, Bolin Creek is still an urban forest. Some sections of the creek back up against higher-end subdivisions. Children can wander from their swing set to the creek's edge. Residents' living rooms look out onto green treetops. The residential proximity, the existing network of trails within Carolina North Forest, and the sewer easement's wide clearing have created a well-worn creekside trail, albeit unpaved for now. An afternoon stroll on the easement sees kids lugging backpacks, slobbery-tongued dogs trotting along on leash, mountain bikers with mud-spattered wheels, and a silver-haired professor types wearing athleisure and ambling along with hiking poles. The existing path is rugged and muddy at points, with the occasional cone-shaped sewer cap poking out of the forest floor and the thin black pipe crossing over the creek's smooth waters. Trees stand on either side of the easement corridor, holding up the creek bank on one side and the hillside on the other. Carrboro resident and Bolin Forest Climate Action supporter Linda Hawk says there would definitely be a loss of trees. If you were to pave the easement, you'd have to dig down deep enough to have a road. The subsurface would be tree roots. Those tree roots go to the trees along the bank on either side. You cut the tree roots, you lose the trees. It may not happen overnight, but it will happen. Hack and other members of Friends of Bolin Creek have concerns about complications related to replacing the sewer line if the greenway is paved on top of the existing easement. OWASA engineering manager Allison Spinelli confirmed OWASA is not scheduled to perform maintenance on this section of sewer line until mid-2028 or 29 at the earliest. Spinelli says, replacing sewer lines underneath a paved trail would be business as usual for OWASA, but the impact on any hypothetical construction timeline is unclear and would likely factor in after the public engagement process. Flink of Greenways Incorporated notes that municipalities often choose to build greenways on top of sewer easements. This has been done in Cary, Hoover, Alabama, Denver, and Ramsey County, Minnesota, among other places. Flink says, I've never had one municipality come back and say, boy, we should never have built that trail on top of our sewer line or near our sewer line or whatever. Greenway supporters also cite the 2009 master plan's note that the sewer easement is already a disturbed area. Trees have been cut to clear a path wide enough for maintenance vehicles, and the sewer line is treated to prevent roots from growing into the easement and cracking the pipes. Dr. Johnny Randall, conservation director at the North Carolina Botanical Garden, sees paving the pathway as preferable to the existing dirt trail. And he says, paving a perpetually disturbed easement, even next to a stream, was always far preferable than leaving it to erode every time it rained and put sediment into the creek. If you go out there and look when it rains, you'll see the water either runs off or pools up in ruts on the greenway. Friends of Bolin Creek director Tom Kors feels differently. He says, why would we want to further impair a system knowing what we know, that putting in impervious surface in a riparian zone is not good for an ecosystem? Other opponents echo Kors' environmental concerns and repeatedly emphasize concerns about constructing a greenway next to a flood-prone creek. They worry about reduced tree canopy, impacts on the macro invertebrate population levels in the creek, and the destructive effects of construction. It's hard to find new ground in an argument that has gone on for so long. Any point that one side makes has a ready-made rebuttal from the other. An opponent to paving says they're worried about reducing Bolin Forest's ability to trap carbon. Those in favor say paving will reduce carbon dioxide emissions by taking cars off the road. That same proponent argues that the greenway would provide students another route to school and reduce rush hour traffic. Opponents assert that children wouldn't use the path in rainy or cold weather and that high school students would never walk or bike to school. They have too much stuff to carry or they prefer their friends' cars. Still, 14 years on, the conversation has reemerged and the town is finally embracing it. Former Mayor Mark Chilton, who was in office in 2009, sees the renewed debate as an opportunity for Carrboro to take meaningful environmental action. He says, most of the things that our planet needs to do on a grand scale are not within the control of our local governments, but we do have control over this, over where we develop and how we develop, how we build our transportation infrastructure, whether it's car-oriented or bike-oriented and bus-oriented. Let's do it, he adds. Let's build a bicycle, pedestrian, and transit-friendly future. The Carrboro Greenways Commission, a volunteer-staffed board, is charged with, quote, recommending policies, programs, and actions that may assist the town in safeguarding the water quality environment, and livability of the community by establishing greenways. But past and present members of the commission say they were told not to discuss proposed phases 3 and 4 of the Boland Greenway in their meetings. Former Carborough Greenways Commission member Charlie Hillman says any time there came a discussion, the town staff had to say, "You can't discuss Boland Creek." Any time the creek was brought up, the Greenway Commission was told, "No, that's verboten. This is Voldemort. We're not allowed to discuss this. Can't go forward." Emails from town staff to Greenway Commission members, dated as recently as November of 2022, internal emails between Carborough Town Council members, dated November 2019, and a video of town council meeting from 2016, and council meeting minutes from 2018 confirm Hillman's assertion. In short, it became clear that charting a path forward was the council's responsibility, and delays in doing so rested on their shoulders. Carborough Town Council member Sammy Slade says, "Oftentimes, politicians try to keep everyone happy. But in this instance, the image I've always had is that it's like a festering wound. We're not following through with what we said we were going to do is the de facto taking action by leaving the status quo." Slade adds there's a, quote, "certain group within the community that wanted to table the discussion indefinitely." Quote, "But what we told the community we were going to do is actually go through a process and thereafter make a decision. The reason why it's taken this long is a majority of the council over all these years has been reluctant to be decisive." Slade also cites construction of other phases of the proposed greenway as the reason for the delay. And Carborough mayor and longtime former council member Damon Seals echoes Slade's views. He says, "It's been easy for the council to just let it sit because we know that there's been some controversy in the past about the project. The reason the discussion's moving forward now is that, frankly, there are people on the council who just want it resolved." Former mayor Lydia Lavelle noted strong and concentrated community opposition to the project. "It's a greenway that runs through people's backyards," she notes. "That's where you find some people get the most upset and the loudest. There were people who did live along it or used it a lot, or on the cross-country teams or are really familiar with it, as opposed to Greater Carborough that doesn't even realize what an amenity this is or could be." Frustration that hardline persistence against seeing a paved greenway shut out debate or progress on the issue, and the council's continual stalling meant the town staff never planned for phases 3 and 4 altogether, as emails between council members from 2019 show. But recent elections saw enough turnover on the council to usher in a pro-development majority, specifically with the ouster of Creekside Greenway opponent and longtime council member Jacqueline Gist and election of newcomer Danny Nowell in 2021 and the special election of Eleazar Posada in 2022, who were both endorsed by Next NC. Gist did not respond for a request for comment. The March meeting saw town staff walk away with a clear timeline for a public engagement process on the proposal. The Boland Creek Public Engagement website will remain live until late September or early October, giving the town staff time to condense their findings for a mid-October report back to the town council. Beyond this, officials hesitate to offer any potential construction timeline. Town staff point to the multi-step process outlined in the original 29 master plan, including identifying funding sources, project design specifics, and meetings with local stakeholders as the next steps in the process. Officials on town council remain optimistic regarding momentum on the Greenway. Slade says we're finally getting some movement. There's a majority on the board that understands we should follow through with what we've said we're going to do. Town Council Randy Haven O'Donnell, the lone dissenting vote in the March meeting, has reservations about moving forward with public engagement. Quote, the scope of work that was offered up was one that did not put the education and information and the need for data up front. And without that being present, you're asking for the community to make uninformed decisions. O'Donnell says they have questions regarding potential carbon sequestration loss, effect on water quality, data and numbers for who would potentially use the Greenway and for what purpose, and more. O'Donnell says they hope there's room for compromise moving forward, and says, what are the compromises? Where do we find that level set middle ground? Because if that is not our objective, then we're looking for further polarization through the process. The work that has to be front-loaded right now is one of community building through the expectation that we're going to find compromises on all sides. But Seals, who is retiring at the end of this year, says he's hopeful that Carrboro will find a way. This isn't unique, he says. There are greenways all over the world, including in places just like this one. We have a lot of other examples to look to that can be instructive and informative and help us to make this decision. To arts and culture now, the section of Indie Week. And this is about glitter, glamour, and stepping out onto Raleigh's burlesque pink carpet as conservatives aggressively roll back rights. It begins with a quote. As soon as you're done, you're like, I just did that. You know what I'm saying? And then all you want to do is keep doing it. There are big thrills in it. There's the thrill of the show when the lights go down. Performers lead you through a haze of flesh, feathers, and light from one world into another. And then the thrill of watching the rehearsal of a show before it's transformed into the polished final product as performers change costumes and slip between worlds. On a sunny Saturday morning in Garner, six performers are running through a technical rehearsal for the Raleigh Burlesque Community's Sweet 16 Anniversary Show, slated for the following week on June 23rd. The rehearsal is at the Showroom, a small storefront space off US 70, bedazzled with fake flowers and neon art. Rachel Haskins, who is organizing the event, began performing in 2007 after a friend of a friend invited her and to try out for a show in Greensboro. At the time, she'd only ever seen one burlesque performance, but she was hooked, and thus was born Rachel Riot, performer, scene matriarch, and part-time teacher of burlesque classes. At the time, she says, the scene was small, just Rachel Riot and a performer named Porcelain, and Legends was the only venue in Raleigh that would host performances. As burlesque has gained a sturdier foothold in the South, more doors have opened and the community has grown. 16 years later, around 100 performers have coalesced locally with frequent scene overlap with other performing arts communities, particularly drag, drag-esque, Haskins calls collaborations. There are fundamental differences, of course. Burlesque has sexual overtones. Drag does not. But both celebrate glamour and self-expression. Both offer a joyful glimpse at liberation. There are now, Haskins says, thriving burlesque scenes in Charlotte, Asheville, Greensboro, Greenville, and Wilmington. Friday's show is a lightly fancy affair at the Lincoln Theater. Holly Pocket, née Kayla Knott, a former theater kid who radiates warmth, will emcee the event alongside a chorus of stagehands, or kittens in burlesque speak. Knott says, part of the job is to vamp, so performers have enough time to get off stage and for the kittens to get all the clothes or feathers or candle wax or blood or whatever to get it all off stage. It's all got to get off before the next performer comes on stage in heels. This show, which features a bill of 16 burlesque dancers, is particularly meaningful in light of the anti-LGBTQ and anti-women ideology sweeping the nation. Much of the burlesque community is queer, overwhelmingly female, and increasingly vulnerable to conservative pushback. Claire Bigham, 25, who performs as Alvara Bigham, who uses she-they pronouns, has wispy, mio fera hair and a thick southern accent and has always dreamed of dancing. And they say, a lot of people don't realize how queer burlesque is. When they moved from Lewisburg to Raleigh in early 2020, just before the pandemic, they stumbled into the local scene. Bingham continues, I'm country, you know. Coming here and knowing other southern people and seeing ways we can be ourselves, despite the way we were raised. Most of us grew up conservative or into real traditional ways of life. And now, because I've met people in Raleigh, and even though it's just an hour away from the country, I can't even imagine being in Los Angeles or New York or somewhere. But just in that county change, I see a lot more ways I can be free and that a lot of people can be more free, especially the LGBT population. Bigham first performed at Ruby Deluxe's Amateur Night, which is where Knott says many dancers find their start, saying, amateurs of all different orientations, all different body types, all different experience levels can sign up and show off what they've got. A lot of these performers started off in Amateur Night, and a lot of the people who book performers go to Amateur Night to look for them. Bigham, dressed in a blue silk dress and garters, is up first at the rehearsal. They pull out a chair and begin to dance as Sexy Silk by Jesse J comes on. That's the brassy soundtrack to the part in Easy A, when Emma Stone's character strides through school with a scarlet A pinned to her corset, a scene from which Bigham drew inspiration. Quote, as soon as you're done, you're like, I just did that. You know what I'm saying? Then all you want to do is keep doing it. A little bit about burlesque. There are already parameters. In North Carolina, legally, stipulations include that performers wear pasties over nipples and panties on asses. In other states, blue laws stipulate the area from the cleave of the buttocks to the leg, defined less than delicately as the vortex, be covered in such a way that if someone bends over, nothing in that vortex is exposed. Infraction can lead to fines, and performers are already in the business of taking those rules seriously. These days, though, they're in the position of taking them a lot more seriously. Across the country, 14 anti-drag bills have sprung up alongside a vast array of other bills that cruelly jeopardize trans and reproductive rights. In Tennessee, one particularly appalling anti-drag bill made its way past legislators in March, outlawing adult cabaret performers within 1,000 feet of schools, public parks, or places of worship, i.e., from within any urban core, before a Trump-appointed judge ruled the bill unconstitutional. North Carolina's version of this measure, House Bill 673, introduced in April, did not meet the current legislative deadline and is unlikely to be revived during the current legislative cycle. Still, says Sarah Warbelow, vice president of legal affairs at the Human Rights Campaign, the introduction of such bills has had a chilling effect. In Tennessee, numerous drag performances and parades were called off during Pride Month as harassment from the far right intensified. In North Carolina, Proud Boys have intruded upon drag brunches and readings, and venues have gotten spooked about hosting alternative entertainment. Haskins said, the North Carolina drag bill would affect burlesque performers as well. I'm relieved the Supreme Court in Tennessee overturned theirs. That sets a precedent for here, too, and we'll probably be okay. But we've already had two venues cancel burlesque shows just once the bill was introduced. Burlesque's origin in the United States is often traced back to the mid-19th century when performer Lydia Thompson crossed the shores with her British Blondes troupe. Prohibition turned touring vaudeville acts into nightclub acts, launching the careers of burlesque stars like Josephine Baker and Gypsy Rose Lee before New York Mayor Fiorella LaGuardia shuttered the burlesque houses in 1937. Perennially poised on the fringes of American dance, burlesque shape-shifted onto the silver screen and into showgirl routines before its popularity petered out mid-century. Burlesque dancer M, who performs as Mae Hemmer and who asked not to have her real name used in this piece, got her start in ballet, then sustained an injury and began to experiment with cosplay and burlesque. Things took off. She's performed and competed across the country and beyond. She is the 2017 Miss Montreal Burlesque. Years into her career, she discovered that performance runs in her blood. Her grandmother disclosed a past life as a go-go dancer. She hid it, M says. Being a woman born in the 30s, trying to get married, she kept it to herself. Unlike her grandmother, M's work as a burlesque dancer is no secret, but she's still cautious. A mother of young children in a small North Carolina town, she's seen firsthand how sexuality can be wielded against a person. A few years ago, after she spoke out against a racist issue in town, she says someone found and circulated photos of her performances. This spurred a barrage of nasty comments, slut and pedophile among them, that trickled down to her children. Now she's put a distance between her home and stage lives. But pushback is not the final story for M or any of the other showcase performers. Theirs is a story about a tight-knit art form that involves hard work. Local performers spend as many as 20 hours a week practicing for and participating in shows, with a liberatory payoff of deciding what to do with your body in a culture that would have you do anything but that. On the Friday night of the anniversary show, weather rolled in to match the drama of the event. The skies rumbled, then split, letting loose sheets of rain and prompting an alert Durham warning. I balked at a tempestuous I-85 drive to the show and almost didn't go. Then at last the storm withdrew into a drizzle. A perfect rainbow panned over downtown Raleigh. Outside Lincoln Theater, along a pink carpet, guests waited in line with glittery skirts, whisking them out of the muddy lip of the curb as attendants scanned tickets. The show began. Boom Boom Bethery was up first, followed by a nervy trench coat routine by Mae Hemmer. M says over the phone, "Once I step on there, I'm no longer Muggle Me. I'm Mae Hemmer. It's like I'm here to entertain you, and I'm allowing that because it's a control thing. That's why it's all about consent. I'm making the choice to take these clothes off. I'm making the choice to extend my gloved hand to you. It's a very empowering feeling, knowing they're here to see you in this moment of strength and being vulnerable on a stage." At some point in the show, I began recording on my phone without really having a good reason to. The stage wasn't close enough to capture good sound. But when I listened back later, the crowd audio from the crowd is clear reason enough. As Holly Pocket vamps and each performer comes on and off stage, the crowd's support, animated with a thrush of woos and yes, okay, is like a sugar rush. Virginia Scare, Euphoria Harlot, Ava Hardiner, and 11 other performers take the stage. Drag queen Twixie Chardonnay and non-binary draglesque dancer Hysteria Cole perform a rousing routine as a duo. There's a ukulele, fans, several top hats. In a pastel fairy getup underpinned by lights, Lady Gatita, née Betty Adorno, performs to a pleasantly hardcore song. Adorno, 50, says, "Everyone performs for a different reason. I perform because it's in my blood. I love being on stage. Being a bigger-sized person, it's a lot harder to get your foot in the door. You can't do things in the traditional routes because there are no spaces for you there. The evening draws to a close with a performance from the drag king Sterling Maxwell, a.k.a. the Lady Man, flanked by the Progress Pride flag, the trans flag, and the non-binary flag as they deliver a powerful speech about beauty, empowerment, and resilience in the face of rights being stripped away. Bigham performed their Easy A routine at the after party. They're just getting their start in the burlesque world, so they weren't part of the main set. Still, a thrill. A meaningful one. They say, there's things about myself I didn't realize were valid because it wasn't the traditional way or the conservative way, but I can do and be myself. I can do this and feel good about myself and feel empowered and talented and feel seen and feel heard. Bigham pauses. I call it magic, but I love it, man. Related in the theatrical performance light is a review by Glenn MacDonald of Theater Camp, which he says, Theater Camp is cheerfully audacious and is now in theaters, and Glenn MacDonald gives this a 4-star review. Rickety, funny, and dizzy with affection, the indie comedy Theater Camp is an ode to that most noble of high school cliques, the theater kids. It goes like this. Camp Adirondacks is, as the name suggests, a performing arts summer camp in the Adirondack Mountains of upstate New York. Founded by the legendary Joan Rubinsky, played by Amy Sedaris, an old-school theater lifer, the camp is dedicated to providing a summer oasis for those who love drama, musical theater, and adjacent disciplines, juggling, say. As a practical matter, that means Camp Adirondacks is a second home and safe space for a lot of misfits and queer kids, campers, and counselors alike. They love their summer camp, and the summer camp loves them. The trouble this particular season is that owner Julie has lapsed into a coma during a production of Bye Bye Birdie. Money is tight, and now the property is being targeted by the corporatized rich kids' camp across the lake. Determined to save the day, camp alumni Amos, Ben Platt, and Rebecca Diane, Molly Gordon, rally the returning campers who need their summer camp like flowers need the sun. Will Amos and Rebecca draw on memories of their own magical summers? Will desperate plans regarding Cole Porter go hilariously wrong? Will the kids stage one last musical extravaganza to rescue the camp? Yes, yes, and kind of. It gets weird. Lead performers Gordon and Platt wrote the script with fellow theater nerds Nick Lieberman, who co-directs with Gordon, and Noah Galvin, who plays the camp's beleaguered technical director. Filmed in just 19 days at an old summer camp facility, the production relied heavily on improvisation from its talented cast. Everyone involved clearly has a deep knowledge of children's theater and summer camps, and the result, a ballistic style of comedy, powered by enthusiasm, specificity, and detailed character work. The focus is also mostly kept on the grown-ups, which is the right choice. The educators at this camp consider themselves artists, you know the type. I particularly like the moment when costume designer Gigi Owen Thiel wheels on a young camper. It says here you're allergic to polyester. Why? In another scene, the adults have a boozy bonfire using the alcohol they've confiscated from the campers. The kids, meanwhile, are left to sort out the lessons of their vital but frequently inappropriate education. One sequence in the big musical finale has children acting out a cocaine sight gag with a giant nose at Studio 54. It's hard to explain, actually. The humor has real heart, but is always delivered with some kind of spin, as when a nervous heterosexual camper finally comes out to his visiting dads. With its high spirit and improv riffing, Theater Camp necessarily suffers a bit structurally. The film's mockumentary conceit is forgotten about halfway through, and the ending is a joyful train wreck of loose threads and half-baked ideas. Several plot points are resolved in post-credit scenes and title cards. But that's about right for this particular movie, which is all about slapdash art and in-the-moment glory. In a way, Theater Camp is a throwback to the kind of gonzo comedies that ruled the early 80s, updated with 21st century improvements to inclusivity and a relaxed self-awareness. In the end, it was the cheerful audacity of the film that made me happy. Most of the movies in multiplexes these days feel like skilled merchants selling engineered products. Theater Camp feels like artists making art, however clumsily. Real people making real comedy out of the stuff they really love. And again, this is called Theater Camp, now in theaters. Glenn McDonald wrote this article and gave the review of 4 stars. And now I have brief time for an invitation from Indie Week for nominations for Best of the Awards. And we've already had the winners released in earlier issues for Wake County and Durham County. And Orange County's next up. The nominate your favorite Orange and Chatham County bar, veterinarian, bookshop, museum, whatever. There are over 100 categories in which you can profess your favorite treasures. After the nomination period has ended, we'll move on to the finals ballot. And they say here, well, the winners in Durham County have already been announced, not Wake County, I guess. So how to do it? You go to Indie Week and look for Best of the Triangle, and you can place your nominations there. And then later on will be a chance for everyone to vote for the nominations to get the Best of Awards. And these have been going on for, oh, I'm not sure how long, 30 years maybe, 20 years anyway. At any rate, this concludes the time available to me to read this issue of Indie Week. I'll just mention my name, John Federson, and I will say that it's available as a podcast. Our initial broadcast of this will be on the 4th of July of August, excuse me, and it could be found at ncreadingservice.org, who is the presenter of this weekly series, Indie Week. So thanks, everybody, for listening, and we'll be with you again next week. Bye-bye.